You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tom Rackman's first and acclaimed novel, The Imperfectionist, was set in a doomed institution, a newspaper office. His new work, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, begins in a similarly endangered setting, an independent bookstore. Tully Zilberberg is the American owner of a bookshop hiding out in the Welsh countryside, and then the mysterious elements of her past come to haunt her as she decides to try to discover the truth about her childhood. It's published by the Dial Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Tom Rackman back to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Did you intentionally choose a title that's only one article away from a work by Paul Kennedy, a famous historian, economist?
I'm glad that you caught the difference. Yeah.
It's a missing a the.
It's a missing a the. That's right. I chose this title because it fit the novel that I had written, but I recognize that it's a very unusual sort of a title for a novel, sounding very much like nonfiction. And there were all sorts of discussions over whether this was a good idea or not. But it does, for me, really bring out three very significant themes in this book. One of them being the rise and fall of influences within the life of the chief characters. A second theme being the rise and fall of great powers in the sense of physical and mental powers over the course of a lifespan, so that you have a child gaining competency and reckoning with the limits of one's powers in adulthood and then losing them in old age. And then finally, I did want a reference to the idea of great powers in the sense of the empires and forces that sway us all.
Because it takes place over three different time periods, and you get the sense that you're saying we're shaped by the forces of history as much as by the other things that come in our lives.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'm saying it that directly. I guess I'm asking the question of what role these major events that are going on in our world have in our own lives. It's something that I find fascinating. You see these huge events, these huge movements going on, and sometimes it's easy to feel that one is rather estranged from it, and it's easy to wonder how one fits into one's own period.
You set The Imperfectionists in an English-language newspaper office in Rome. This one is in Wales and elsewhere. Does that grow out of your own experiences? You were born in London, raised in Vancouver, and then you lived in New York and Rome, among other places.
Yeah, I think it does. I think that you know, when I was growing up, these various moves that I did tended to dislocate me somewhat from any sense of an identity linked with a particular place. I never had that growing up. And when I first started to want to write, I wondered whether that was a problem because I didn't have a fixed place. I didn't have, you know, Dublin that Joyce had or anything else. So when I wrote The Imperfectionists, it was set in the world of the people that I understood and knew and sympathized with, and that was these expats who are slightly floating between cultures.
Well, the sense of alienation and dislocation is a major theme in 20th century novel.
It is, and 21st in this case.
Well, yeah, well, but I guess it's something that with globalization is going to be more and more.
I think so. I mean, I think that concern that I had of not having a particular setting, I think in the end nowadays with people are more internationally dispersed than ever. People are born in one place and moved to another, married to a person from a third, with kids maybe speaking a fourth language. So I think that perhaps this question of where you fit is more relevant now than it ever has been.
In structuring this book, you move back and forth in alternating time periods. Why did you choose that format?
Well, I was fascinated with watching this character develop over time. And when you the development that everybody has over the course of their life is so incremental that you never really recognize the huge shifts. There's this sense that it's one person, one self that continues on, but really you're many different people. And I wanted to bring that out by having parts of her story when she's in her 30s juxtaposed with those when she's in her 20s and when she's 9.
Well, Tully doesn't even have the identity of an expat. She's part of no community except the people she's with.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. She comes completely unstuck, you could say, because she makes so many moves when she's a child and continues to do so later on.
Did you write it in chronological order and then break it up?
Yeah, that's
because it would get very complicated trying to remember what you'd said in an earlier
part. I always had the intent of chopping it up in this way and then reordering it, but I wrote it I wrote it chronologically in order that the story worked and that it all fit together.
Many authors say that they don't know what's going to happen when they sit down to write a book. Do you work that way?
I have somewhat of a sense. I have an outline and I have a story and I have the characters, but I think it would be impossible to know precisely what's going to happen over the course of 380 pages. So, in fact, one of the most vibrant, lively aspects of writing is not being entirely certain what's around the corner.
And it seems to me you couldn't have worked it out totally because the threads are so complicated. And as we said, they go back and forth in time.
Yeah. I had many of those worked out, but I had to figure out quite how they would all tie together.
Is there any reason you chose the specific years of this book, 1988, 1999, 2011?
Definitely. It's a book about this woman's life, but I also wanted it to be a book that somehow engaged with the times. I wanted to be writing a book that had something to say or at least observe about the present day. And by doing that, I wanted to describe the past quarter century. And I set these three sections at very particular times, 1988, just before the end of the Cold War, and then 1999, 2000, just the point of American dominance before the wobbles that followed, and then the present.
Before
9/11, absolutely, and also all of the complications in many other respects in the years since then, and then in the present day with the suggestion that perhaps there's something ahead here that we don't know yet.
Your last book was at least partly related to your life, its characters, with the staff of an international newspaper, and you had worked at the International Herald Tribune. In the case of this book, I'm hoping you were not raised by people who might or might not have been your relatives.
Well, I was raised by people who were my relatives. I was raised by my very good parents who didn't do any of the complicated, difficult things that these ones did in this book. So, this one's not based on my life at all. This one's just imagination.
The book is The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, Tom Rackman's latest novel. It references to Nicholas Nickleby appear repeatedly in your book. Are you kind of telling the reader that you're thinking in a Dickensian way?
Well, I'm telling the reader that the main character, when she's a child, is thinking in a Dickensian way.
And although she reminds me a lot more of Pip in Great Expectations.
Yeah. But that's a very good point. However, in Nicholas Nickleby, there is early on in the book, it's set at this horrendous school for outcasts, and Nicholas becomes a teacher there and saves one of these wretches and takes him away and shows him a different sort of life. And that's exactly the sort of story that is in the head of this character, Tuli, who is stuck in a miserable school that she hates and has fantasies of somebody taking her by the hand and leading her away, which then prepares her for all that happens.
The Dickensian displaced orphan child on his own theme.
Exactly.
And Tuli almost sounds like a Dickensian name. There's a relatively minor character, the teacher, Mr. Prittles, whom you describe as a 30-ish Englishman with trendy denim shirts and gelled ginger hair. And that is a kind of a specialty of Dickens, the beadle, the vicar, the teacher, the oppressive, self-important minor character who specializes in making a sensitive child miserable.
Yeah, well, I think that that Dickens, in addition to being a great influence on this character, is somebody that I associate with my own childhood, because I remember being read his stories, listening to them with the family on audiobooks and things like that, and having his characters really infuse my life in a way that I don't remember any other fictional characters having done at that early.
Tuli is told at one point, and then she repeats a version of this to another odd child later in the book, that people are usually suited to be children or suited to be adults, and she will be much happier as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that's true, or is that your character speaking?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I wouldn't declare it as an absolute fact, but I do think that there are probably people who enjoy more childhood and less adulthood, and others who are longing to grow up. I know that I was part of the latter group and spent much of my childhood, you know, longing for the day when I would be able to buy all the chocolate I could and eat it in one go.
And I would think that most people wind up being happier as adults because they have more control over their lives.
Yeah, I think there's this
notion. They just don't play as much.
Yeah.
Or some do play.
Many do. I mean, I think there's this notion that childhood is carefree and easy and fun and all that, but it's also a situation of great powerlessness and extraordinary frustration and inability. And I remember well how hard it was at times.
Books and the idea of fiction also feature prominently in this novel. Many of the characters are heavily dependent on reading as a survival or an escape mechanism. Is it their way of blocking out the world or entering into it?
That's a great question. I think it's a bit of both, really. I think that what's interesting for me about a character like this, a bookworm, a child who is that she is really discovering the world for the first time, not through the world itself, not through her experiences, but through experiences as they're recounted, as they're told in tales. And so it provides for her a company. It provides adventure and all of the heroes and villains that she's not able to find in her rather sad real life.
And many children who live transient lives escape through books. Paul, the man who's taking care of her in the 1988 period, provides her with a selection of reading that ranges from Treasure Island to Cujo to Fear of Flying. She's 10 years old and she's given Fear of Flying. What effect do you think that would have on a child?
Yeah, a very confusing, troubling one, I imagine. I mean, he has no idea. He's not a bookish person himself, but recognizes that this little girl is. And so he, at every airport they stop at, he'll just grab something from the bookstore and hand it to her, and she'll work her way through it, pour through it, and he has no idea what's getting into her head.
Later, when she has a bookstore, which seems to be an appropriate business for her, she organizes it to include some rather odd sections, such as authors who are mean to their spouses.
Yeah, there's aspects of that bookshop are my fantasy bookshop with all sorts of volumes falling out over the
much better than
place.
Just fiction or nonfiction.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you were a journalist, so you also think about fiction and nonfiction. The next person who she is with is Humphrey Ostropoler, a mysterious Russian who takes on her education by instructing her reading, but he only reads nonfiction and warns Thule repeatedly about the inferiority of fiction. As a former journalist, this is something I'm sure you've thought a lot about.
Yeah, well, that was in part inspired by a family member of mine. I remember having a long conversation with him about this question. I was making the case for fiction, and he was arguing that there's nothing that you could possibly write in fiction that could be more extraordinary than that which has happened in real life.
Often fiction, of course, is closer to real life than nonfiction.
Well, also, I mean, you know, part of my argument for fiction is that it offers something that nonfiction can't, which is an opportunity to enter into other lives, into other people's thoughts and minds and experiences in a way that simple recounting of the outer events, the outer world that nonfiction does so well cannot offer.
Humphrey seems to believe that fiction imposes a false meaning where there isn't any. He says he believes that nothing means anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's his claim. He's of the opinion that as soon as there's a beginning and an end to his story, then it forces some sense of right and wrong within it, some little miniature world of justice or injustice. And he believes that since in reality there is no end to things, not really, it doesn't represent how things truly are.
The ideal of journalism is that it's objective and objectively true, but anyone who's tried to write a memoir knows that we always are shaping things, that there's always an element of fiction in pretty much, in fact, in any newspaper story, whether the reporter wants it to be or not, there's a shaping which somehow takes it away to some degree from the realm of reality.
Yeah, I think that the difference is that in nonfiction, you start with all sorts of facts, and you try to hew as closely to them and try to maintain be as clear and as objective. And with fiction, you start with all sorts of imagination and try to make it look as much like reality.
There is for the reader and for Tuli a big blank, a wall, an inexplicable gap in her understanding of her life, partly because she hasn't had all that much interaction with other people.
Yeah. I mean, it's partly that, but I think it's also because there are all sorts of confusing mysteries about her life when she looks back at it, when she thinks about the experiences that she had, the places that she was. She realizes that she was looking at it in only seeing a tiny portion of what was going on.
But she also was being fooled and actually also fooling other people.
Yes.
Are we always an accomplice to the people who fool us?
No, I don't think so. I think that unfortunately being fooled is often a consequence of being an honorable, decent person. It's a sad truth.
After being fooled, do you think it's always possible to go back, as you do in the book, and I assume Tuli does, and revisit those moments when we could have put it together, when we could have recognized the truth?
Well, I think it's tempting to go back and chastise oneself for not having figured it out when one should have. But at the same time, I think that often if you look at the circumstances of the cases of one's deceptions, when one has been deceived, that it was as a result of, let's say, trying to be kind to somebody, trying to be respectful and decent. So you can't kick yourself, or you end up just changing yourself and becoming a terrible cynic.
In the case of these characters, you seem to be saying the truth can really set us free.
Well, I don't know whether the truth sets these characters free or not, but it certainly I think allows them to define their lives a little bit better than they had been previously. If they have such a blank behind them and their past is nothing but empty, then it's very difficult to know how they should be in the present.
The Imperfectionist was a bestseller, got incredibly great reviews as well. Did that put any pressure on you?
I don't feel that it put pressure. I think it was an amazing encouragement, really, because people had read the book and been interested in the next one, and so I was able to write one. But, I mean, many, many worthy authors get one book out and, you know, just don't have the fortune that I happen to have. And so I think that if I were to look at the fact that I was going to do another one and feel that it was too much pressure, it would be the wrong approach.
Do you think that your years as a journalist helped you overcome some of the problems first novelists have?
Well, I think that those years helped in that I had spent many hundreds, if not thousands, of hours working on words, and therefore I had a certain basic facility with it, which helped. But I did need to figure out how to write fiction, and that took time.
The Rise and Fall of Great Powers is Tom Ruckman's latest book. It's published by the Dial Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much for having me on.